Last session, the first time, we spent the time with a book by Harold Kushner, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. I want to leave a little bit of time at the end for any questions. I know that that was a lot of material and not enough time to discuss. I promise you today that, because it's just an article and I've really cut it down, that it's a very short presentation and much more time for our input, which I really think is very, very important. I'm glad it's a little bit of a smaller group. I think maybe we can feel more comfortable in sharing a little bit. I have extra copies of this article for anybody who'd like them, and if I have a dozen. If you need more, I can Xerox them here. It's a very, very good article by black theologian James Cone, and it's taken from his book, Black Spirituals and Blues, and in which he examines the theology behind the black music. I found this very interesting. It continues much of the same discussion we had yesterday, with the same sort of focus on suffering and how, as a community of faith, we can be faithful in the midst of that. I think one of the questions that Rabbi Kushner asked towards the end of his book is really, is it the best question to ask, how could God do this to me? That question of why God, why me? Which is very natural. It is something I think every human being asks themselves at various points. But I think what Rabbi Kushner is saying, that at a certain point, that question becomes not very helpful. It's kind of like you spin your wheels, because intellectually there is seems never to be quite the intellectual answer that we would like for that. What I found helpful in this article is that the black spiritual tradition focuses more on the question of how can the believer live in the midst of suffering and be faithful to God. And I have this question up there. That is the key question for the black community as they struggle with their particular situation. And I think, as you know, that particular historical situation was a very difficult one, in which they had no freedom. They were geographically scattered as slaves, and any member of their family could at any point be sold and sent to any other part of the country or state. They were physically abused. They really had very little. They had very little sense of community among them, even a spiritual community in the physical sense, so that they were forced to rely more on the spiritual resources in order to survive. And I think that tradition has a lot to teach us as white Americans who really have not suffered very much in comparison to that sort of suffering. The kind of questions that Rabbi Kushner asks, and a lot of other philosophers, come out of the Western world particularly. They are philosophical, very abstract kind of logic questions of how can God be good, just, and all-powerful? How can God do this to me? They're questions that look for some sort of an intellectual or philosophical answer. That kind of question was not innate to the black spiritual tradition. Because of their African heritage, they were not schooled in that sort of philosophical thinking. So that we're looking really at a whole different way of approaching reality when we talk about the black tradition. One of the most basic differences, I would think, is that the black community assumed that God was a good, just, and ultimately all-powerful God. I'm not all-powerful in the day-to-day sense, because they saw the contradictions and they lived with their prayers of asking for liberation, and they saw that those prayers were not answered in the historical context. But ultimately, they did not question that God had the power and would ultimately liberate them, as God had liberated the Israelites in the Exodus and and has God had liberated Jesus through the crucifixion and resurrection. In the Black spirituals, I'm sure you've all listened to them, there's a very notable contrast of feelings. There's often great despair and alienation expressed, but often, most usually, there is a great deal of confidence and joy expressed, even in direct opposition to those feelings. And I wanted just to read the lyrics from one, just as an example. Nobody knows the trouble I've seen. Nobody knows my sorrow. Nobody knows the trouble I've seen. Glory, hallelujah. And in this particular context of Black spirituals, that glory, hallelujah, isn't a denial of the suffering they've experienced. Rather, it's an affirmation that even in the midst of their suffering, they know God is with them and that they can affirm and celebrate God's presence. I find, in particularly with the theme here at Holden for the summer of celebrating life, I find that really ties in really very well with the Black spiritual tradition. Praying and singing together, worshiping together as a community, celebrating the Lord's presence, even in the midst of their brokenness of their lives and the community that they live within. The main focus of the Black spirituals is on the community life. There is a very definite predominance of lyrics that deal with the various aspects of what is it like to live in a community of faith when you're in the midst of oppression, when you're being whipped, when you're being sold, when your family members are being killed. How can a Black slave affirm that community of faith, build up that community of faith when so much destruction and evil is destroying and pulling apart that community? And one of the songs I wanted to again read lyrics from deals with particularly that issue of alienation, of feeling so alone in that community sense because of the separateness of the family, because of the difficulty of even assembling and singing together or praying together. And it goes like this. I couldn't hear nobody pray. Oh, I couldn't hear nobody pray. Oh, way down yonder by myself, and I couldn't hear nobody pray. Oh, brothers, let's go down to the valley to pray. Oh, sisters, let's go down in the valley to pray. Oh, children, let's go down in the valley to pray. By and by, we'll all go down, down in the valley to pray. And you hear in that the yearning for being together in prayer, and yet the recognition that often that they are alone, that we are alone in prayer also. And another lyric that follows on that theme goes, I must walk my lonesome valley. I got to walk it for myself. Nobody else can walk it for me. I got to walk it for myself. Jesus walked his lonesome valley. He had to walk it for himself. Nobody else could walk it for him. He had to walk it for himself. So we find that the theology is not idealized in the sense of Jesus is going to take all this pain away and do it all for me and make it all better. But we find, I think, a very realistic and honest look at what it's like to live as a member of the community of faith, recognizing that there is much loneliness in that spiritual life and that that's a part of it. But beyond that, that there is a much deeper yearning for the time when they can, as a faith community, physically together, pray together and be united, and ultimately to be united through the resurrection in that community. the basic thrust of black spirituals is celebration of God's presence. It's a very firm conviction that God is with us when we suffer. There's very little questioning of that, as opposed to say, the Krishna approach. There is an acceptance of the fact that, yes, God is with me, that I have been encountered with God's presence through the singing, through the praying, through the living out of the Bible tradition. And one very important way in which they did that was through the Bible history. And you've heard salvation history, meaning just the whole historical sequence of events that is told to us through the stories in the Bible, the beginning with Genesis and Exodus, the prophets through the New Testament and the crucifixion, the resurrection of Jesus. The slaves took that history into themselves in a very personal way. And I think in many ways it was because their history had been taken away from them. They had no freedom to move where they wanted, to do what they wanted, so that this salvation history became their own life. And they identified with that to a very, very deep degree. And through that, they felt God's presence. They could affirm that God was a liberator, because they knew God liberated the Israelites. They knew that God ultimately would liberate them from their slavery. And I think finally, just the basic theme that I found is one of their strong belief that God remembered them no matter what happened to them. And one of the lyrics that you probably know the melody to is, do Lord, oh do remember me. Do Lord, oh do remember me. When I'm in trouble, when I'm down low, do remember me. Sometimes I'm up, sometimes I'm down, sometimes I'm almost to the ground. Oh yes, Lord, do Lord, oh do Lord, do remember me. Do remember me. And that's again just a very basic example of the kind of juxtaposition of the suffering they're going through, the being low, being alone, and the celebration that God is with them, God remembers them in the midst of that, and the celebration that the music brings to that. And I think you remember it, just the toe-tapping quality to most spirituals is a very upbeat, even though some of the lyrics can be very very realistic and very down. It's still there is a very dynamic mix of those moods and of those affirmations of faith in the midst of that song and poetry. So I wanted to stop there and ask for any questions, and then discuss some of these themes, particularly the themes of community and how it is that we as a community of faith can help each other in the midst of the various personal sufferings we each have experienced or as a corporate community have experienced. And please, if you have some questions from yesterday and want to bring up some of those themes, please feel free to do that. Yes?
I do have one question I didn't have time for yesterday. You work with the children.
Yes.
And you work with the parents, of course, closely too. And sometimes when you find that there are people, and mostly you find them, I think, who just can't get a hold of themselves, and it's so hard, and they have other children at home that they have to deal with and live with, what are some of the words and some of the things that you do to help people when they're just in agony about their child either dying or being extremely ill? How do you console them?
I found that the most helpful thing is to be present to a person. Often there's a real sense of aloneness. That's one of the probably the worst feelings that accompanies that sort of suffering is I'm alone. Nobody really understands. And as a chaplain, I'm not a medical person. I don't, I'm not identified by them as being someone who tells them about their various drugs or prognosis. But I'm identified more as someone who can enter into their experience and to listen to what they're going through. I find listening is the basic thing. You never know where a person is until you listen. And some people want to have some faith kind of inspiration. They need that. And some people have a very basic faith that it's just there for them. But what they want is somebody to be there with them. At particularly at difficult times when they're newly diagnosed, when the child is maybe not doing well, when there's a difficult decision that's having to be made as to what treatment to be made, when the child is dying, and in preparation for that, I find that's one of the times I'm most active with families, is helping them to talk with their children, to be honest, and to spend time alone with them, to try and get the medical staff out of the rooms, to give them the freedom to take away the lives of, you know, the tubes and those sorts of things if that's what they want. One example is of a child who, a 9-year-old who had cancer, and she had gone through many chemotherapies, and none of them were really helpful to her, really. She had had 3 relapses. And finally, the doctor, sensing her suffering, suggested or offered to the mother an alternative of taking her off her chemotherapy and allowing her to have the freedom to leave the hospital and go home if she wanted, or just to go on day trips to do various things. And I had been a part of their life for some months, and at that point I could help them by arranging different things. We did some fun things together, and that that was a real gift to the whole medical staff to see this child be able to celebrate her life and to do the things she really wanted to do. And then we were preparing for her first communion and helping her to, you know, to talk about, you know, her faith and to help her family affirm their faith. And then at the time of her death, we were there, I was there, and with them, and, prayed at a point where they wanted. So, tell us a little bit, Ian, about your experiences in South Africa.
Well, this is the most interesting session because it certainly verifies what I saw this winter. I had the opportunity to go to the Republic of South Africa as a mission visitor for 3 weeks from our church, AALC. And as there were 5 of us, 2 from Minnesota, 3 from Minnesota, but as I visited with our missionaries there, but into the black church, and we had an opportunity to attend the black church each of the 3 Sundays, and 2 Sundays happened to be the time they were installing new bishops in their diocese. And it was just a rejuvenation for me to see their faith and their love of God. And they just, they really celebrated their faith in God. They just sang beautifully, and they had church for 4-hour service. And when they went after out of the church, and they don't sit in comfortable chairs, they have benches without backs. After 4 hours, they were singing just as joyfully as when they came in, with a beat and a happy sound to it. And then visiting the churches or the blacks who have been separated from their homes or move out of their homes where they're living and into the homelands. It's a very tragic thing. They just come and say, someday we are moving you because we don't want you in this area. And they move into hostels, they move them into these homelands, which in the first place they are moved to remind me of the reservations for the Indians in our country, to the poorest part of Africa where nothing could grow. And they move in there to build a one or two room brick house, but they have money to build it, then they build cardboard houses in addition because the whole family lives together. There's this family unit there. They are brought there, and yet they seem to have a faith. They go to church, they're made like pastors, and I'm sure of those, but they have this faith. And they said to us, please go back and pray for us. That was really the one thing they asked us all the time, will your white brothers and sisters in America pray for us? Because they really believe that God will come to their rescue, that God will liberate them. They believe there's a time coming in the Republic of South Africa when they will have some freedom, and now they have none, because they're not citizens, therefore they cannot vote. And they can never get into Parliament to help with anything with the laws. But they have this enthusiasm, and they give, really, of their, I said they give of what they don't have. Because we would go to church, and we would go to visit the women at the church, the prayer women. And as they march around to give their little coins, and then halfway through they would stop and they count the money, and if they didn't feel everybody had given what he or she could, they marched again, singing and beating. We love God, and God is great. And they would give some more. So they give of whatever they have, and they have so very little. And even these people in the homelands, which are very, very sad. The children never have milk after they're through nursing. They just isn't milk for children, and there's very little food. They still have this faith. They still sing. They still believe God will answer prayer. And they work. And this family is mine of our black, of the Negroes there in pre-Civil War time, and even up to the segregation, even in our own country in 1962. The families are split. They will take the father, and they will say, you are going to work in the gold mines at Kimberley, but it's too far for you to come home because they have no cars. Only 10% of the blacks in the Republic have money for cars. They have a bus system, but that gets too expensive, too far away. So there are times that a father gets home only 3 weeks a year. And in the meantime, he is living in hostels, which are dorms, and the nice dorms over here look like palaces and more. So they just don't. four, five, six, seven men live in one room with just a cot. And you can see the situation that develops there. The family back home, and the money is sent home, of course, for the children to live. So we may think the father is in a really bad situation, but this happens to mothers too over there, who are the breadwinners. They too have to go to the way to work from home, and they live in hostels. Some of them get home maybe once a month, some a few months, and there are some of those who only get home once a year. Grandmothers, aunts, uncles, take care of the children. But I suppose one of the greatest things I took away was that enthusiasm and the love of God, in spite of all that. And I think I guess we have too many comforts that interfere with our faith. We don't have to rely on God. We know we do when the chips are down, but really, you know, we have everything. So we just don't rely on God as much, and that's all they have, is God. And they really, truly have all such faith in them. And I just couldn't.
Are there any questions for Anne about that experience? She was 6 weeks in South Africa as part of the Lutheran delegation. I think we'll have a chance later on this evening. There will be in the forum a discussion of the World Council of Churches agenda and different global issues that will come up that will include these. So, yeah, sure.
Well, I have a comment to make in relation to that, having lived in Tanzania, which is part of that continent. And comment about how you see yourself in many third world, but very much so within many parts of Africa. And that is in a circle. We in the Western world see ourselves much more in a hierarchy, and God is at the top, and then it's men, women, and children, and whoever happens to come below. Within very much the African experience, God is in the center, and we are in the circle. And in that circle are those who go before, those who are here right now, and those who are yet to be. There's nothing non-Christian about that. But it makes life and death part of one whole. And so when you talk about control, which we spoke about very briefly, but kept hitting at yesterday, because when we talk about God being omnipotent, we translate that as God controlling. Mm-hmm. I do not believe that many third world people perceive God as a controlling God, because clearly their lives are not in any kind of controlled state. But we, in our cultural situation, we are always wanting to be in control. I mean, we've not only bit the apple, we've all but eaten it. And so we're so busy being in control that when things go out of control, and we want to be in control in our hierarchy, then suddenly God is in control. Now, up to that point, we are. Our successes, they're ours. Our quote-unquote blessings, however you interpret that, and I have different interpretation of what blessing is. I don't term blessing a success and physical well-being and all that, but then we are in control. But suddenly, the unexpected, and then the question comes, why me? In third world, you'd say, why not? Because that is part of living. I am just like anybody else, and the unexpected is part of life. The undetermined is part of life. It is very possible it's going to happen to me. But because I'm in a circle, I'm not sitting in this hierarchy by myself. I have a community that's a we-oriented, not a me. And that's the difference, tremendous difference between Western world and what we've bought into that goes into the capitalism, the whole cultural framework. Mm-hmm. So that if you have a circle, then you do have the upholding arms. And those are translated in very many beautiful ways. So that the overpowering, or the, which I said, the omnipotence of God is translated in an unchanging love. That's an omnipotent. And as solid as the Rock of Gibraltar and never changes, the fact that life changes is very known, because especially if you're so close to subsistence living, so close to life and death matters, you never forget that. So as you say, we've had many things that have intruded into that as we have quote-unquote progressed. Again, I might question that. Mm-hmm. And we have lost whether we ever had a circle. I'm not too sure we ever did. But when God is at the top instead of in the middle, then we are asking very different questions, and we respond to one another in very different ways.
That's really, really helpful, I think. The assumptions that we make without even thinking about God, and they taint everything in which we see. And I think so much, if we can let go of some of those assumptions and bring in the international perspectives of other faith communities to enrich our culture and our heritage, that we'd be able to live out a much more whole faith life. Is there any responses to Shimon? Yeah.
I got a question. There seems to be some kind of a connection between the black spirituals you mentioned and poor whites, say like Appalachia, places like that. They have their own rich kind of a spiritual, you know, sounds like the circle being broken and things like that. And there's some kind of a similarity there. I'm not sure, maybe the similarity is just poverty. I'm not sure, but have you ever made any connection or kind of followed that through?
No, I haven't. That's an interesting comment, though. I'm not familiar with that particular type of music, the Appalachian ballad, is it?
Well, yeah, the ballads too, but still, old songs that, I sort of remember my grandparents singing in the Baptist church when I was growing up. When I got older and began to venture out, I run into people, white people from, southern towns, a farming community, who sit around and play guitar, and they sing some of those same songs, mm-hmm. you know, with a different twang to it, you know, but it's still the same stuff.
And same ideas.
Yeah, and I was wondering.
But the situations, like you said, probably you're, you know, not having so much of the comfort and the distraction to get them away from their faith life. Probably a very common thread they share. And the different culture just manifests itself in different musical forms, but basically affirming the same need to celebrate and affirm their unity in their suffering and in their life, and they're celebrating their life together. Did you grow up in the South?
No, well, I grew up in Kansas City, but my parents and all of my relatives were from Texas. And I went to Baptist churches. Even after I became a Lutheran, I went to Baptist churches, you know, for various revivals and mm-hmm. things like that all while I was growing up.
Mm-hmm. Have you found the Lutheran church is able to, is it very different from the Baptist tradition?
Yeah. in most ways, because the Lutheran church, you know, theology is so heady, and Baptist theology is real heart oriented.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was interesting. It wasn't real connected to the land, you know, like say Indian theology. You know, it's not. So there's no real connection to the land. It's sort of that quote promised land kind of a thing. But that's more of a spiritual thing than a physical land oriented. You know, kind of thing. I was just, and another question I have, you know, about the session here and the sessions you've done on suffering. I'm not sure what kind of theology can come out of that. Are you trying to get Westerners, you know, to give up some of the comforts and live simply, or develop a theology that helps us cope with all the luxuries we have, or, you know, I'm not sure mm-hmm. where our theology is going.
I think, well, I was thinking in response to Anne that there's a lot of social justice themes that come up with this when you see yourself as a community, a worldwide community of faith in a circle, and you realize the kind of practical, political, as well as the faith connections around the world that raises a lot of issues of how do we live, you know, what standard of living, what political actions as a church do we take to try and bring more justice to the world, to unite the community, the body of Christ around the world. So I think there are two edges to this. Part of the intent of the class is to help people to cope with their personal suffering and their corporate suffering. And the other is to really look into the prophetic side of that and to realize that there's a need, there's a prophetic word being addressed to us through the traditions, particularly the Black faith traditions, that demand of us a faith response, and, and not merely one of just praying. I mean, I affirm that as very important, but I think that churches need to do more than that, and that there's a lot of churches have a very hard time moving beyond the prayer aspect to the practical, where do you send your money or how do you live your life and what corporations, you know, do you invest in and what do they do and who do you support for presidential candidates and the whole gamut of political life.
This is a very, very real issue, and we're about to get into it here because it really is a little different, but I think one of sad things, we, and parenthetically here, but we know there's a lot of poverty in many of the countries of South Africa. Now that is not the case in the Republic of South Africa. They are a rich area.
13% are white and they own 87% of the land. There's money there, the gold mines, the diamond mines, the platinum, the sugarcane. But there is a matter that the whites have it all, or much of it. And also in the Republicans out there, there's the highest percentage, I believe, of Christians of any place in Africa is there. And to me, that really puts a burden upon us as Christians that we will try to, that these other Christians down there will think differently, and they are doing a little of it, and there have been, of course, many, many Christians, white Christians down there, I have been in prison politically for a long period of time because they couldn't stand on this. So that's a fact. They have money there, but it's just that it's not.
Did you visit with the Lutheran Church, were there Lutheran churches in South Africa, white Lutheran churches?
Yes. I did a couple, but not very many. I did have a chance to, we had a very good 2 hours with Nazi, Ian Nazi, I guess it's pronounced, who has been banned from the South African Church because of his stand, and plus 125 other pastors. And he took a stand that you cannot be a Christian and believe in segregation or believe in apartheid. And he said that it has to change down there. I did talk to some southern sugarcane farmers, a couple of them, as I say, I don't pretend to know very much after 3 weeks, just sharing a few things I did. But he said, we don't believe in intermarriage, but he said, we realize the blacks are going to have to be treated better. Now, the blacks on the farms seem to be treated quite well. They have fairly nice places to live, they're well fed, and they kept to have black schools, which are so poor, of course. But it's the people who work in the cities, on the homeland, I believe they are.
There's still such a division, like even when you describe that, well, they're treated well, it almost sounds like our pets, you know, like they have good food and taken care of, and yet not the equality,
no freedom.
When this lady and what Anne has spoken with the other lady, when she has spoken of people working together as a community and as in a circle, in a group. When there is a big disaster, just a small part of it, right? Perhaps it isn't a religious theme there, but when there is a disaster like in this country, a big flood, a fire, an earthquake, the people will gather together much better and help each other out. And you know, if that was a spiritual theme, that would be so much better. But it's there they have, perhaps their homes were wiped out completely, and so really they have nothing left of as far as their house and furnishings and so on are concerned. And you know that right now, if there was a big disaster outside, we would all be very close, and we would all try to help each other. Well, those people that have nothing, like in Tanzania and the people that Anne had worked with and seen, they put God in the center and work around. And so perhaps that is because we have so much, but it is shown just so slightly when the people have nothing for a while, how they help each other out.
I've seen that in the hospital, in times of crisis, there is a tremendous sense of community among parents there in the hospitals who are, each of them, going through tremendous, terrible things, but there is a kind of a strength and a love and reaching out that is really amazing to see. I think that's, you know, when we talk about the gift of community, that's really at the heart of it, is the ability to transcend our individual needs and to really become united.
I was thinking too, isn't that another thing that isolates us or keeps us from helping each other in our suffering, is that another message that we've gotten is that we're strong, we're whole, you know, we're successful. And therefore, we don't let our wounds show. We don't let our vulnerability show so that we can't become a community and feel identified with one another in our pain, which it seems like the blacks, it's right out there, mm-hmm. You know? It's right there for people to see and know, and there's not the hiding. And so therefore, it seems like there can be a closeness that can help to ease the pain. Mm-hmm.
And I think that an honesty, talking about more about how the students are, I mean, just Westerners generally tend to be very intellectual, and it's hard for us to be very honest and open with our feelings. And yet it's only through sharing those feelings that others are able to perceive what our, you know, our needs are, to come together to give the support that we all will need.
That's an issue that strikes me pretty deeply, to be one that has come up several times in discussion, that the real contrast between feeling suffering and thinking about suffering or talking about suffering.
Mm-hmm.
It strikes me that you can talk about what happened to you at one point, but it's an entirely different thing to talk about how you feel about what happened to you. And I think it's sometimes easy for us to use our faith to intellectualize a suffering position and even try to explain it like theology might do, as opposed to using our journey to in a faith light to explore how we feel about our relationship to things at various points, how we feel about our relationship to God, how we felt about our relationship to a person as we were feeling irreconcilable with them, or how we talked about a situation when it was irreconcilable, mm-hmm. totally unacceptable in some way.
We talked a little bit about that yesterday, with the difference between recognizing the grieving, the needs of just going through a grief cycle, versus the theological need that some, we all, I think, have a tendency, an impulse to come in and in the midst of the kind of the acute pain to say something kind of trite sometimes. And I think what I've found with people is that there's a real sense of yearning for people just to be with them in their feeling level, just to experience that with them. Just sit there with them and be a part of that, and to affirm them as people going through that, not try to make it better necessarily, because they know that there's nothing that can make it better in certain situations, other than that sense of somebody who loves me and cares enough to be there is with me. And certainly that sense from God is the thing that carries most people through, that deep sense that, you know, I can sit here and feel alone, but I sometimes can feel God's presence, sometimes I can't feel it, but I know that God is there with me. Yeah.
So much of, it seems like so much of what we go through on a day-to-day basis is so attached to, you know, if you show any feelings that are not positive, attached to non-success. You know, if someone says, "How's your day?" If you say anything other than great, then, you know, it's like people will assume, or you feel that people will assume that, you know, you're wasting your time, you're not motivating yourself, you're not using your time wisely.
There's something wrong with you.
Yeah, yeah. And it seems like that maybe the heart of all of that, you know, and is to be able to, you know, if someone says, "How are you?" to say, "Well, I'm not doing so well today," without having to assume that your whole life is falling apart. You know, just to say I'm not in a very good mood, or, you know, I'm just kind of down today, without having attached so much else onto that or something. And I'm not sure theology in terms of what we say about it can relate to that, but in practicality, you know, without positive thinking and
pull your own strings and do whatever you can, you know, all that kind of stuff going around, mm-hmm. you know, how that can actually be helpful.
Well, I think one example of that is this whole idea of the punisher God, and the tendency we have to blame a person for their situation, the blacks for their situation, well, they're, you know, and all this trite, terrible things that we say about that. You know, they deserve it, they're, you know, they're stupid, they don't have the drive. Just, you know, there's a tendency to blame people in their suffering rather than to try and understand, to listen and to understand and to find out what really is happening. And not to automatically kind of, and a lot of that comes through the theology, which is really unfortunate, which I think is why the Krishna book is really helpful, to really start to look at the kind of judgmental theology that we are taught and how that filters into our whole sense of judging each other as human beings. And it's very tragic that at the times when people are suffering the most, that we have those tendencies seem to come out the strongest. And once somebody has said a comment to you, you clam up. You know, you don't want to trust anybody else to listen to you because it's hurt. You hurt you so badly. So I think being a non-judgmental and a community that can offer unconditional love is, you know, at the heart of our faith. Just as you spoke of God, as that's the image of the omnipotence of God, is that this is a God of unconditional love that no matter what will not waver. Any other questions or responses? Yeah.
This is sort of different.
Sure.
You said political. A while back, when I was thinking about the kind of sadness I feel over people, their reaction to the president's statement. It was mentioned this morning when he was saying that all the evil resides in the communist nation. But the fact that he said it, where he did, and to whom he said it, bothers me a lot. I feel a kind of sorrow that Christians can't be together, that we don't kind of pull together as community politically. And I frankly don't believe that all evil resides in the communists. And I am at odds with that idea. And I know that there are a lot of people that agree with that idea. And I grew up thinking that. And I just simply don't believe it anymore. And so I feel a sadness that we can't be together in where we think evil resides.
Doesn't that even go back to what was said about not being able to accept our own negative stuff?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is that we have to project it onto anyone else that will take it on,
mm-hmm.
instead of allowing ourselves to have both sides in us, and them to have both sides in them.
That's because we've projected it onto the environment.
Yeah.
It's evil. Step on a spider. Take a snake. You know. As if that's where evil is. You know. And I wish we could be more of a community.
How can that happen with this?
Just love. That's... We have to express love, and that's as I see it. That means that we have to say that we have problems and troubles, and the Psalms do that all the time.
Yes.
They cry out in one sentence, you know, I hate this whole mess. Come down and strike me dead. The next sentence is, they put, God, I love you so much.
Yeah, the Psalms and the spirituals are very much the same pattern. Because the Hebrews had that ability to be very honest in their feelings and their to really put juxtapose the different feelings of despair and faith.
They weren't really afraid to be angry with God at all. They just got real good mad.
Mm-hmm. I appreciated Kushner's book for that, just for his honesty, because he has not been afraid to say, you know, of course everybody wonders, you know, why did God do this to me? And says, maybe he feels that anger. You know, to me that was a real liberator to here's a person within the faith community affirm that as part of being a person of faith. And to say, well, you don't stop there, but that's certainly a place where you begin, or it can be a place where you begin. And I think in our churches, that's a very important thing.